Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and we are here with...
Samuel Adams playing Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart.
And...
Ian Merrill-Peak playing Salieri.
And, of course, Amadeus here at Folger Theater, now through... Remind me the date?
December 22nd.
December 22nd. Nice long run here. 2 months to see it. All the way until Christmas. Yeah, deck the halls with boughs of Mozart. Awesome. Well, obviously, the Milos Forman thing is one of my favorite movies of all time. Best Picture, 84, the year I was born. People forget that, you know, the screenwriter that adapted it from his own play, right?
Yep.
So the three of us know what it's about, but who wants to just take the general premise in case maybe younger audiences don't know? It's a genius little idea for a play.
Yeah, it's a genius little idea about a little genius. The basic story is, you know, the sort of rivalry, the rivalry between Antonio Salieri, who was the more established court composer of Vienna at the time, and then basically the new kid on the block, Wolfgang Mozart, who is, as we know, you know, the genius musical prodigy. He meets Salieri, who is, I think, what should we say, like, kind of confronted by or challenged by his unexpected virtuosity, and then a rivalry springs up between them, a lot of jealousy and conniving and that kind of thing.
Yes, and I mean, I just think it's such a great idea because, you know, in any other time, Salieri would have been probably the, you know, the heralded composer, you know.
Well, he was heralded in the time. That was the thing. But he was aware of the actual genius of Mozart and that he would never be as good as him. And so that destroyed his life and made him a dark, dark soul, which Sam is doing to me
mm-hmm.
4 weeks in.
Yeah. We're taking a real method approach with this production, yeah. So that's good.
I hate Sam Adams.
Yeah.
I hope you live beyond the production, though. I hope you...
Yeah, right, you know. We're going
to
see... Yeah,
we're going to have to come back.
It is a Christmas play, so we're going to open the presents. Yeah.
All right, but in terms of playing that character, how do you, you know, what do you dig down into in terms of, you know, being that accomplished person who just knows, you know you're gifted, you know you're the one of the most talented, you know, composers of your generation, but knowing that you're never going to be, you know, as good as you are, never going to be as great as this young prodigy who doesn't seemingly have to work for it like maybe you had.
Well, being a regional theater actor, you know, I'm keenly aware of all this. I feel that I'm certainly accomplished as an actor, and there are other people that I watch in movies, and we've talked about them today here, and that I think, wow, I'll never be able to do that because they have a platform to do something. Now, whether they're more talented or not, who knows, because it's a different medium, but I completely understand artistic jealousy, so it's not really hard to tap into that, and I hate Sam Adams. So...
The actor, not the beer.
You're going to get no, sued.
I like it.
Cut
that.
Careful.
I'll drink any beer. I find it, you know, it's incredibly well written. It's this great arc. And oddly enough, you know, in the movie and when you think about the play, you think of him as a bit of a villain. And I'm much more interested in playing him as not a villain and that he's trying to find what makes him do the things he does. And I think there's legitimacy to... some of his behavior. Now, he goes a little farther than maybe you or I would, but his soul is crushed. If you have infinite belief in a higher power and that higher power starts effing with you, then you're going to start doing some strange things, I think. And so, and he understands by the end of his life what he has done. Now, also, we have to let everyone know, this is completely fictionalized by Peter Schaffer.
Right.
Historically, we know that they were actually... They knew each other and they were friendly. Mm-hmm. There's no evidence of any of this play being true, except that they were both composers at the same time.
Yeah,
and Mozart did die young.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there were little weird rumors that it circulated in a town like, you know, Vienna, which was super gossipy and super prone to scandals and kind of conspiracy theories. But yeah, it is largely a completely fictionalized event.
And I don't want to spoil anything that happens, but I think most people have probably seen the movie, but does the play, similar to the movie, hint that maybe you might have lived longer if not for you?
Absolutely. Okay. I mean,
maybe even more so than the movie.
The rumor circulating, right, was that Salieri poisoned Mozart, yeah. And in the play, what Peter Schaffer talks about is that he does, but it's emotional. He mentally poisons him, and he sort of gaslights him throughout. He says he's going to do things and he doesn't. He says he's not going to do things that he does. And Yeah. No, I think, it, according to Peter Schaffer, but I think his point is a much bigger one, right? It's about artistic genius and jealousy and how we deal with these things, and he just uses these two as a vehicle for that story,
right?
Which is pretty damn clever.
And what's also kind of interesting is that, you know, Salieri doesn't do anything explicitly to Mozart. He kind of creates a world that doesn't appreciate Mozart, and that was kind of true. You know, Mozart was very popular throughout his lifetime, but wasn't nearly as popular as he probably should have been, or certainly as he thought that he would have been.
He was a gimmick. I mean, everyone. I mean,
yeah,
people.
Yeah,
oh, that was so great. Let's go drink.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Whereas Salieri was important and mattered, and he was the most famous musician in Europe. Mm-hmm. And according to Peter Schaffer, knowing the entire time that he was way down from this genius freak.
Do you think Mozart's untimely death, you know, obviously added to his, you know, it's one of those posthumous things where people, you know, you got to die to be famous, kind of a thing, or at least be taken a serious, not a gimmick.
It's weird because, you know, there were composers at the time, like Haydn was incredibly popular during the same, you know, he was one of a contemporary with Mozart, and he was hugely popular. So it's hard to say why people become popular and when they become popular and what the kind of cause of that is. What's definitely known is that, you know, Mozart dying at 35, the amount of material that we might have had after that period, you know, he wrote over 600 works by the time he died, and to imagine what he, you know, what kind of compositions he would have had when he was an old man would have been kind of amazing.
That's well, also to go back and listen to his stuff, you go, oh, that was ahead of his time.
Yeah,
it was, you know, it makes me think of James Dean and what his body of work might have turned into. I mean, you see what he starts doing in Giant, and you're like, this is going to be one of the great actors of all time. And
Giant's so underrated in my mind. Oh, everyone remembers Rebel.
That whole stuff with the lasso,
the
whole story behind it, and
the movie itself.
People just
didn't
know what to do with James Dean because he came in and he was so he jumped up two generations of acting style and to where we got to.
We caught up eventually.
We did. So, and I feel like Mozart was probably the same thing, where people knew this was a star, but they didn't. And he was a one trick pony as a kid, right? He was going around touring Europe with his dad and doing all sorts of tricks with the piano. So, you know, it's hard to take a child prodigy seriously, even though you think, oh, they're going to be the greatest thing, but they're still a sideshow, and it's hard to take them all that seriously.
And when you're impressed with something and you don't really know where to put it, you don't know where to have it, because maybe it is, you know, like you say, like jumping a couple generations, it you know, people become paralyzed by that kind of confusion. And so I think a lot of times people just become unnoticed or even rejected because people just don't know where to have them.
Is that why you look so confused when I'm acting?
I think
because I'm like
why.
Two generations ahead of the stuff.
I was
happening.
Thinking two generations, but not ahead. I'll
oh,
try.
You were going
yeah.
ahead. Okay. Oh. Okay. I hate Sam Adams.
Yeah. I love Ian Merle Peaks. He's great. It's such a joy.
And the rivalry exists even here off stage. You were mentioning about how you try to play it. You specifically tried to play it different than F. Murray Abraham, you know, in terms of, you know, maybe less villainous.
Yeah, I don't twirl a single mustache in this
thing.
There's
no mustache.
No.
Folks, he doesn't have a mustache.
No, but he is. I mean, he does have evil thoughts, but the playwright himself has him questioning his motivations. Mm-hmm. And throughout, he'll say, I'm going to do this. Oh, my God, I can't believe I just thought that. Mm-hmm. So that's in there. And I think to disregard that is doing injustice to the playwright.
Yeah.
And because if it was just a bad guy, good guy story, it would be, those are boring. Mm-hmm. There's complexity in everything. And so trying to pull that out is what interests me. It's like Iago, right? Yeah, trying to figure out what makes this guy tick and not just purely evil. I mean, he is purely evil. He's a sociopath. But but trying to figure that out so the audience can be complicit in the act as well. Mm-hmm. And I do think intrinsically he is a sympathetic character.
Oh,
and that's the trick, is trying to make that clear.
Absolutely. In terms of your performance, we all remember, you know, what was his name? Tom Hulce, Animal House, best. We remember, the first thing I think of is that laugh,
really.
You know,
yes.
Do you play it that over the top, or is it, like, you know, what's your take on it compared to that?
I mean, it is kind of written to be pretty over the top. Yeah. I mean, that's sort of one of his whole sort of points of Mozart, is that he is over the top and nobody knows what to do with it. It's weird because, you know, the movie is so excellent, and I think Tom Hulce does a really great job in that role. It's funny because the way that this play is written, it doesn't have a whole lot of room for interpretation. It's not like a Shakespeare play where you can kind of set it on the moon, or set it at a, you know, at a bank or whatever. Like, this play wants to be done exactly like this play wants to be done. So the fact that there's a really good kind of pre-existing version of it. It's difficult to know exactly what to do with that, and I think the way that we've been going with it is just to do what is sort of authentically our version. Whether or not that's similar to or very different from the film, I personally am not trying to think too much like that. But it's definitely still the over-the-top quality is inherent in the character, I think.
Absolutely. And it has to be, because that's also what gets under your skin so much and drives you nuts. You're like, who is this wild, brash kid that's getting all the credit? You know, you almost has to be like that.
Yeah.
I haven't gone back to watch the film since it came out. Yeah. And I was going to, mostly for the Italian, which I'm doing very dodgily. but I think you guys will appreciate it. But, you know, I tend to not go back and look something so it doesn't feed me. I'm horrible at impersonations, so there's no point, really. And
watch it after Christmas.
I will. I actually will watch it afterwards. But, you know, F. Murray Abraham and I are very different actors, and we actually did a reading together once. And
really?
There's a funny story I'll tell you later.
Yes.
Yeah, not here.
I'll circle back to that.
Yeah, right. And so I'm, as an actor, what I've always, why great plays can be done by a lot of different actors is that you're going to put your spin on it, your interpretation. So I don't want anybody else tainting what I might do or throwing ideas in there that aren't mine. Sure. Or the director's or what I'm doing with Sam. You know, we can create it ourselves.
Sure.
As it should be.
Yeah.
How does the music factor in? Because we have all these, you know, Mozart compositions, but, you know, describe, you know, as an audience member, how, you know, how's that woven in, you know, stopping and starting between, you know, the dialogue? How's that actually woven in? Because, you know, in a movie you can do certain things, mm-hmm. you know, but here, you know, how's that woven in?
Well, it's interesting because the director, Richard Clifford, you know, initially described the music as sort of an additional character, which is really what it's kind of become. It's such a huge presence in the play and in the story, obviously. You know, you're dealing with Mozart, music is going to be a pretty important factor. So we've been sort of folding the music in. It's, you know, it's written out in the play what pieces of music are included and how they go. But the more that we, you know, have been working in the space and working with all the sound and the tech and everything, we find that, you know, having that music, it just kind of lifts everything up. It takes the work that we've already been doing and just kind of brings it to a new level.
I just forget how many really good songs Mozart wrote.
Yeah.
You know, you're like, oh, that's him too. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
There's monologues inside of the music as well. And normally when I'm doing a play, I hate background music because it's telling the audience what to feel. Right. Mm-hmm. But in this, it's so helpful because it helps me to feel what Salieri might have understood, which was his demise, right? He was looking at his own death. He was looking at what music can be and what God had given to this creature and what he would never give to himself. So it's just, you know, it's very, very powerful stuff.
Do you remember which, or not do you remember? Of course you remember. You're doing it night in and night out, and you're rehearsing for it. But remind our audience, our listeners, what all some of the famous pieces.
Do you remember? Oh, yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I've been doing a lot of research on Mozart in the last couple of weeks.
Right.
And it's just a hobby. And, you know, there's a huge range of things that he wrote. And one thing, you know, I'm a pretty big fan of classical music, but one thing that I was never super interested in was opera. And that was one of Mozart's huge domains. I mean, it's hard to say, like, do you remember, you know, the 25th Symphony or something like that?
When
I don't know.
Hear,
yeah. That's the thing, though, is when you hear Mozart, you know it. You know, everything from everybody has, like, you know, you just, it's like Shakespeare, kind of. You know, you get phrases that just get caught in the you know,
lexicon.
In the lexicon, and then all of a sudden it just becomes something that everybody knows. That's like Mozart, you know, there's tunes that everybody will be able to recognize.
So the Shakespeare Theater is the Mozart Theater here for a little bit. The other thing you think of, you know, obviously when you think of the play and of course the movie is, you know, it's those great grand period costumes too, with the wigs and the outfits.
Oh, yeah.
You know, dish on, dote on, costume designer here and what we have here.
Mariah Hale is the greatest. She's really, really good, and she's collaborative, which is something for... I wish all costume designers were just like that. She wants to know what makes you feel good, how your thoughts on the costume, and she actually hears that. I'm not saying all costume designers don't, but she does it on a level that makes you feel part of the decision-making. And she hasn't done this period before, and you would never know it because she's knocking it out of the park. Everybody looks fantastic. Literally in rehearsal, people will walk on stage and there are audible gasps in the house. I'd be like, wow, that looks great.
Describe the costume for me. Paint a visual picture for radio.
Well, this guy comes out, this Samuel Adams, who I loathe. Well, it's close. And he came out yesterday in a blue wig with this gorgeous blue jacket covered in flowers. And, I mean, it stopped rehearsal for a minute or two as we all just sort of thought, what the hell are you wearing?
Yeah.
And it looked fantastic. And they're literally making it by hand as we go. Mm-hmm. Little elves down, and the Folger elves are putting this all together. And
Folger's, it's right near Keebler, right?
It's right next to it. Oh, yeah, okay, Keebler's next door.
They used to make coffee here.
Yeah. It smells great here. Okay. Yeah.
Cool. How about the set? Are we doing sort of a minimalist idea, or describe what we see backdrop wise?
The set has kind of one big shape to it. You've got kind of like shooting out of the center of the stage are these big things that represent kind of the inside of pianos. You know, so it's these big, long, I don't know exactly what you'd call them, but like piano strings stretched all across the stage. So it gives the sense of you've got this great kind of golden musical iconic look, but it also is sort of like prison bars, so it's kind of confining.
But then they're capped by musical notes, so it looks, I mean, it's very evocative.
Yeah, I'm looking at a picture of it right now. And
but, you know,
yeah,
they also sort of look like God rays from the In the Sun, and they sort of being trapped behind bars, and it's because it all takes place in his mind, in Salieri's mind, so...
That's probably what his mind. I just saw that picture. It's probably what his mind would look like.
Cage,
the gold, the God rays that are also the bars, because you, like you mentioned it earlier, that he feels like, you know, God is sort of effing with him. You just said,
and so him.
Visually, talk about how visually that is. I mean, that visually, that's what's going on here.
Well, you know, it's very funny because I'm usually looking out at the audience, so I don't see them. But every time I go out and look at other folks on it, I think, well, every single audience member is going to have a different response, and I think that's what's so wonderful about set by Tony Chizik is that you create these images and everybody's going to see something a little bit different. But I think they all work. Yeah. You're going to see bars. You're going to see musical notes. You're going to see God rays. Whatever you're going to see. And maybe you'll see different things throughout the show. But I love that. And so to just know that that's behind me and that it's my mind is very, very helpful because a lot of the work is being done for me because I'm lazy inherently.
Watch out. I hear there's a young buck about to take your spot.
No. He's not that young.
Tell me about yourselves. I want to know about you guys. Not even involved with this show particularly, but, you know, how'd you get started? Where'd you grow up? You know, was it like a high school theater production or, you know what I mean? Give me a little, you don't have to do the whole life story, but, you know, the condensed version.
Well, Ian was born to a theater family, so he's kind of got it in automatically. I don't, though. I had to kind of claw my way into this. No, I spent the last year in D.C., actually.
I'm going to start playing violin for this bullcrap.
Right. I moved to D.C. about a year ago. I went to a school here called the Academy for Classical Acting and just sort of realized what a fantastic theater town D.C. is.
Where did you grow up before you came here?
I was born in New York City, and I lived there for the most part of my life, went to school out there, and have been working there as an actor, you know, for the last, you know, ever since I graduated college. And, you know, doing a couple shows regionally and that sort of thing. But when I came to D.C., the Folger has been, you know, it's one of my kind of bucket list places just as an institution.
Sure.
I wasn't expecting to work here quite at this point, but so it's fantastic to do that.
Awesome. How about you?
I was raised in a theater. My dad ran the Boar's Head Theater in Lansing, Michigan for 37 years. And then I moved out to New York and struggled, and I started working in Philadelphia, and so I moved to where I was working, and I've lived in Philadelphia since 98, and I travel all over the country and do plays. That's like 130 plays I've done. I've been a professional actor for 30 years, which is so horrifying to think about. And, you know, the Folger's one of my favorite places to work, so I come back here as often as I can. The stage, the space is so wonderfully intimate, and yet the size of it allows you to, you can do anything. You can be small, you can be huge. And the audiences here are just super duper smart. And they get things that most audiences just aren't going to get. They're just they're a special group. And I feel very fortunate to have this as an artistic home.
Absolutely. Well, you guys have been generous with your time. But sort of in closing, you know, why should our listeners come on out to this? Maybe they've... they've seen the movie, or maybe they haven't. You know, maybe it's their first time to it, or maybe, you know, they love it and want to see what you guys have done with it. But, you know, why should they come on out?
Well, you know, you come for the story, stay for the music, whatever, however you want to put it. I think this is a great story and there's a reason it's constantly being told. Whether you think you know it or not, I think every version is going to be a little bit different because of the people that are involved. I think that one of the things that I, the first time I read it, I have to be honest, I didn't love it. I didn't have a way in. And then I started working on it, and I was immediately in love with it. And I think anybody who comes to it, it might take a second to get into it, and once they get into it, they're going to get lost in the sort of made-up history of the whole thing. Because a lot of it's true. And Peter Schaffer's done a really good job of creating these two fellas who are very, very different. I think it's a great story, and I think people should come.
Right. Anything you want to add?
Yeah, no, I think exactly that. You know, the fact that it's a story that you know, it's kind of like Shakespeare. It initially looks like it's in a very specific time and place. You know, you got all these costumes. It might seem a little foreign, but it's actually an incredibly universal story. And there's a lot that people can relate to in terms of both from Salieri's point of view, from Mozart's point of view, and as an audience, I'm sure they're going to share in all of that.
And you need to come in here as laugh. I mean, it's so good. It haunts my dreams.
Dare I ask?
Oh, no, you got to come see it.
You got to come see it. All right. Thanks, guys. Again, Amadeus at Folger Theater now through December 22nd. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, buddy.
Thank you.